One of our pioneers in many ways was the Reverend Dr. Charles James Taylor, better known to most of us as Charlie. We all have experiences of what T.S. Eliot described as moments of annunciation, those moments when we become aware of another dimension of existence, and at some level we sense the pull of the beyond called the infinite. We are more alike than we are different. There are many aspects of Charlie Taylor's life that I could speak of. This man who was born in Summerside, Prince Edward Island, he was the son of a car dealer who lost his business during the 30s. He grew up in a strong Baptist family which had a strong social conscience, a family background and a church background that laid the foundation for his life, that took him from home to the employment in the Canadian Bank of Commerce, to the service for Canada in the Merchant Marines during the Second World War, and back to the bank in Spring Hill, to a call to ministry and his studies at Acadia University, where he received his Bachelor of Arts and his Bachelor of Divinity. Then his call to further study, where he went to Andover Newton to study clinical pastoral education and was under Earl McKnight's tutorage. We could talk about all of that, or we could talk about his pioneering work in clinical pastoral education as the first one to teach it in a theological seminary in Canada. We could speak of his pioneering spirit in establishing the clinical pastoral education organizations called CAPE and now called CASP. We could tell of his time as chaplain of Acadia University and his part in the building of the chapel. We could speak of his leadership within the convention during the stormy years when Acadia moved from being totally controlled by the Baptist Convention to being less controlled. We could speak of Charlie's influence in the many lives that he has had over this 86 years of his life as he journeyed with many students on this earth, as he journeyed with those that were sick in hospital, as he journeyed with those who were on the margins of society within the prisons. We could talk about those individuals who found a calling in their own lives, such as I did, because of their experience with Charlie, into various specialized ministries in hospitals, military, or prison chaplaincies. But this only speaks of things that Charlie did. And today, I want to take a few moments to help us remember, or perhaps for some, get to know a little of who Charlie was. Charlie was, above all, a person of deep spiritual awareness, which issued forth in loving action. His philosophy, Dr. McGregor, his philosophy professor, Dr. McGregor at Acadia, when he was doing his BA, accused him of being a mystic. I think those of that know us knows that there was a very mystical part to Charlie's life and his ministry, and his belief, and his spirit. So I want to share Charlie's words, not my words, but Charlie's words describing some of his journey. I don't have time to give you all of his journey, but I want to share with you some of his journey. And I'm going to share that out of Charlie's last book called The Call of the Beyond, which was quite appropriate, Moments of Annunciation by Charles Taylor. In this book, he talks about numerous experiences. And while he was writing it, I had the privilege of many times sitting with him and hearing some of the stories firsthand. So I want you to come with me this afternoon for a few moments, and I want you to come with me first to Spring Hill. A young clerk within the bank in Spring Hill is approached by the superintendent of Sunday school from the Baptist Church, asking him if he would teach a youth group. And his response to the superintendent was, "I need some time to think about it." And so we see Charlie first walking on the hills out back of Spring Hill, Rodney. I was trying to remember the name of the area. Rodney, the hills of Rodney, which, by the way, are the hills that St. Luke's Center and Spring Hill overlook. The sky was alive with stars. Oh, that, this goes back before that, I'm sorry. I jumped ahead of myself. But as he walked over those hills, he was walking with his landlord's daughter, a dog. With his landlord's dog. Three-legged dog, mind you. It had been hurt in some kind of a accident and had lost one of its legs. And so Charlie and the dog were tramping over the hills, trying to figure out whether or not he should teach this youth group. And as he traveled there, he found something come alive within him, that directed him that maybe he should do this thing. He had the time. He had the ability. And so he became a Sunday school teacher in Spring Hill. And then the war broke out shortly afterwards. He left the bank to join the Merchant Marines. And he served with them for a number of years during the war years, at which time he met Charlotte, who would become his right-hand person. I can't think of Charlie without thinking of Charlotte. She was always there. Always there, supporting, encouraging, and being very much her own person. And so, they continued. And their life took on a very different direction than he ever thought would happen. And so we hear his words as a young boy, in which he says, "The sky was clear. I laid myself down on my back under a cherry tree near to the family group. In a way, however, I felt alone as I looked up into the Milky Way. A tingling swept over me as I considered that space never ends. It was the first time I experienced the sense of mystery. As I grew older, I continued to go back and reflect on this experience. For me, this was my first existential experience of God. Years later, I came across an observation by the Roman Catholic theologian Karl Rahner that God is the mystery that surrounds us. And so, as a young boy, he began to experience that presence of God as mystery. And perhaps that is one of the things that we try to get away from in our modern world so much. And then he experienced that again as he walked with that three-legged dog on those hills of Rodney. It was a Sunday afternoon late in September when I took the dog from the home where I was boarding and went for a walk in the countryside. The hills were aflame with red and yellow maples and browning hackmatack against a background of green spruce. Standing there amidst such natural beauty and contemplating the pastor's request, I felt as though I had one foot going in one direction and the other in the opposite direction. I needed to make a decision. When I returned to my boarding home, there wasn't a soul around. I went to my bedroom, and though I couldn't remember ever praying in the middle of the afternoon, I got on my knees and prayed. I don't know what you want of me, but you open the door and I'll go through it. This brief prayer was to eventually change the focus of my life. And eventually, as he was working with the bank following the war years, he was asked to go to Newfoundland, to St. John's, Newfoundland, where he was once more involved in the bank. And one night he was invited by a friend to attend the church with her. And as the sermon progressed, he says, I became aware of the noise from the street where children were playing and shouting in their joyful excitement. Then from a greater distance, I could hear the band of the Salvation Army approaching. My interest became caught between the carefully crafted sermon from the pulpit, the street noise, and the jubilant playing of the band. If Christ were to return at this moment, I asked myself, where might I expect to find him? I think he would be out on the street. This was indeed a moving moment for me. The door was opening, and the decision was pressing upon me to step through it. 2 months later, I was at Acadia University beginning my studies for the Christian ministry. Charlie, as many of us will remember, was very much like Earl Merrick, that some of you might know. Earl was certainly a mystic, if there was ever a mystic. He was a teacher of Christian education at Acadia, and he was a missionary for many years in Bolivia. But in the old days when Sawyer Hall was still there, some might remember Sawyer Hall besides me. Am I the only old guy here? You could walk into Sawyer Hall at times, and wafting from the upper chambers of Sawyer Hall, you could hear perhaps the most classical music that you've ever heard in your life, or you could hear some good old country coming down. And you never knew what was going to come. And that was Earl Merritt type of thing. Well, Charlie Taylor, you never knew what Charlie was going to be playing either, whether it was going to be something classical or whether it was going to be Johnny Cash in Folsom Prison. But he had this great appreciation of music. And he tells of the time he first heard a live performance of Handel's Messiah. He says, I had never actually experienced a live performance of the Messiah until one fall evening at the Rebecca Cohen Center in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Here, the Nova Scotia Symphony Orchestra, with a large choral group, breathed life into Handel's masterwork. Then it happened. As the audience stood for the Hallelujah chorus, I felt as if I were standing in the stream of time. On another level, I was conscious of the powerful declaration of the Messiah, and he shall reign forever and ever. In that moment, it was as if time and eternity had touched each other. It was a transcendent moment. As Kierkegaard would have described it, the tangent of eternity had touched the circle of time. It was for me a moment of kairos. Not only was Charlie interested in many things, music was certainly one of them. Another was art. And his tastes in art were eclectic. He had many different styles. But one of the pictures that hung in his office, and one of the pictures that had great meaning for him, was Dalí's Christ of St. John of the Cross. Sharon and I had the opportunity a few years ago to be in Glasgow. And we went to the museum and saw the actual painting of Dalí's that was there. And it certainly is moving to stand there and see that. It touches some core within you. And this is Charlie's description. He found a print of the painting that he saw for the first time in Boston while he was there. As I walked across the Boston Common, I was in tears. I was glad I didn't know any of the passerby, for I couldn't have explained what I was experiencing. For a few minutes, I considered writing a check on my Canadian bank account. However, if the print affected me in this way, I didn't think I could have it hanging on my office wall. I went my way. But each time I was in the city center, I went into the bookstore to have another view of the picture. On my return to my Canadian workplace, I acquired a full print, hung it on my office wall. Many years later, my wife Charlotte and I were in England and made a special trip to Glasgow, Scotland, to view the original painting which hung on the walls of the Glasgow Art Gallery. As we sat viewing the painting, we were interested in the comments by others who passed by. Some did not stop, but a little girl about 12 years of age stopped in her tracks and stood for the longest time viewing what has been considered Delhi's greatest painting. In a letter to the trustees of the Glasgow Art Gallery in 1952, Dalí wrote, "My ascetic ambition in this picture was completely the opposite of all the Christ painted by most modern painters. You have all interpreted him in the expressionistic and contortionistic sense, thus obtaining emotion through ugliness. My principal preoccupation was that my Christ would be as beautiful as the God that he is. The painting was based on the vision recorded by the great mystic, St. John of the Cross." Truly, if you ever have the opportunity to see that, you will certainly remember it. Charlie spent many of his latter years, particularly in and out of prisons. He started a program in 1968 at Spring Hill Institution called Kairos Marathons, which were a type of group therapy session with a spiritual base to them. That program continues to this very day. It is a program that has been recognized by numerous criminologists and forensic psychiatrists as one of the best programs, especially for lifers, those that have committed murder. That is how I began my work in prison, was by going to one of those events. But Charlie has touched the lives of so many prisoners over those years that I must share at least a couple of stories from those years. When I first met Fred, I was certain that he was in his 60s. His face was worn and leathery, and when his deeply sunken cheeks broke into a smile, his chalk-white teeth gave me an uneasy message. I wasn't sure whether the smile was one of warmth or anger. Later, I came to feel that it was a bit of both. It was a smile that covered the deep hurt and anger of years spent in some of the toughest prisons in Canada. When we met, he was serving the last part of his sentence in a medium security institution. About 2 years before he died, he was given a series of temporary absences, which he used to begin a program of study at university. Following his release, he and I were in touch fairly often. But just before Christmas one year, he was taken to hospital with pneumonia. The doctors discovered that he had over 100 scars on his lungs from previous bouts with pneumonia in prison. For these, he had received little or no treatment. This time, his whole system shut down. His lungs filled up. He thought he was dying and rang for a nurse. He was rushed down the corridor to intensive care and gradually rallied. One evening, I received a telephone call. Fred wanted to see me, so I got in my car and drove to the hospital. As I walked into the room, he was sitting up in bed. A smile lit up his face from ear to ear. He was breathing heavily as he stretched out both hands towards me. We were glad to see each other. I sat down beside his bed. Then, with measured breathing, he told me about his illness. "I thought I was dying," he said. I nodded with gladness that he was still alive. "I asked my wife to call you. I wanted to tell you what happened. When I thought I was dying, I recalled all the things we had shared in the marathons. They all came back to me. Do you remember one time you said something to me about being dressed in a robe of white?" "Yes, in fact, I was thinking of that tonight as I drove over to the hospital. The night I said that to you, I was feeling how much you must have suffered during those years in prison. It made me recall a passage from the Bible where it says, these are the people who have come safely through the great persecution. They washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb." "That is it," said Fred. "That's it. And when I thought I was dying, I said to myself, I have that white robe on, and Christ is beside me, and I'm ready to meet God. I wanted you to know that, Charlie. That's the reason I asked to see you tonight." No other words were needed. We were standing on holy ground. One other story, and this is Charlie telling it to you.
Reading from Slashing Up. "Hi," Jake said with a sigh. Actually, he didn't look any better than he sounded. Weary, depressed, the lines on his youthful face told the story of a heavy heart. He didn't appear to have very much energy as he sat down in the large stuffed chair in the chaplain's office. "Things going rough for you this morning?" I asked as I closed the door and took the chair across from Jake. "Just feel like slashing up. I can't stand it anymore." He sat back against his chair, threw his head back, and closed his eyes. "Why? Why?" he cried. "Why can't I have a pass to visit my mum who is sick? Others seem to get passes. Why can't I?" I had known Jake over a long period of time and knew how much he cared for his mum. In fact, he seemed to be the only one in the family who genuinely cared and had not written her off. They trust other guys. He choked up, and there was a lengthy silence. As he looked at me, I thought I could see that his eyes were moist. "They don't trust me here, and they don't trust me in my hometown either." My surmise was correct. His eyes were moist. Now there were tears. Breathing heavily, he recounted how a fellow prisoner from his hometown had told him that everybody was saying that he was nothing but trash. Nothing but trash? "Well, I don't think that God makes trash," I responded. "There's a beautiful passage in the beginning of John's Gospel which tells us Christ, the light that comes into the world and shines on all mankind. That means, Jake, that you have the same light in you as I have in me. God gave us both light. We carry his image." Jake was looking directly at me. Our eyes were glued on each other. "There is another line there that I really like, Jake. It says, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has never put it out." To me, those words mean that no matter what we have done, God doesn't abandon us. That underneath all the debris of our lives, Christ's Spirit calls us. He loves us. For me, that is what the cross is about. It's God's message to us that He loves us, forgives us, heals us. The time was ticking by much too fast. Jake had to be back at his workplace. Before we finished, he reached out his hand to mine, and we had a prayer together, placing his hurt in God's hands. Then, gripping my hand tightly, he said, "Thanks. I feel a ton lighter."
I hope that in some small way, this glimpse into the life of Charles Taylor has helped you to see the man. Not just the works, not just the things that he's done, nor the influence that he has had, but that you can see the man himself. I'm going to close this with a very personal story. The week before Charlie died, I had the honor, the privilege, to visit with him in his home. As we sat in his living room, as I had sat there many, many times over the years, we talked about a number of things. And then Charlie looked at me and he said, "I want to share a dream." So I said, "Fine." And this is the dream that Charlie shared with me. He said, "You know, I had this dream last night. And there was a group of people on the bank of a river. And I was there and on the bank as well. And I looked, and here was a man all dressed in white coming across the river to meet me. And I said, 'What do you think it means, Charlie?'" That's the question he would ask us. And his answer was, "I think that the Pope and I are going to meet." "And we're going to have a lot of good discussions." Of course, I couldn't let it go at that. I had to say, "Well, maybe you're going to meet the Pope on the other side of the river. But maybe you're the one that's crossing it." And he just smiled and looked at me and says, "Maybe." Charlie Taylor has touched many lives. He has been a force within ABF and from day one. He has been a mentor to many people. But he was a man of deep spiritual faith. He faced the hardships in his life, the depressions, the tragedies, being hit by a train, and losing a student, and all the rest that had happened over his life. He had faced all of those things. And still, he was one that always had a message of love and hope for all. Because he believed firmly that only love heals. Thank you.